RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
12 years ago, Troy Hall was fighting for his life in hospital with third-degree burns across 60% of his body, unable to move or talk. The then 22-year-old had been electrocuted twice while picking avocados for work on an orchard in Tauranga. Troy was told he would never likely walk again, but he vowed to recover. Now he's 35 and a dad of one. He's since launched a successful avocado delivery service and most recently a mental health awareness program. A word of advice from Troy. Troy Hall is with us. Troy, thanks for coming on. Wow. Wow. Hey, big wow.
Thank you, mate. Appreciate it.
Okay. The first question that pops into my mind, apart from saying what an incredible journey, and I'm going to be so interested to find out about it, is what's it like to be electrocuted like that? I've had a few, you know, bumps off the mains in my time, and I know that gives you a hell of a shock, but this is next level. What was that like?
There was no feeling at all, mate, to be fair. I just blacked out, so I didn't feel anything whatsoever. I think maybe the force of the power maybe just put myself... Well, obviously, the first one killed me, so... You know, that made everything stop and I just blacked out. I wish I could give you guys an amazing story of I went through this and that. But to be fair, it was just a blackout moment. And 30 seconds later, when the second one went through my chest, brought me back, that was what my father had seen. So my father had seen the second one and seen me up in flames and 6 meters up in the air on the cherry picker. So, you know, that was quite a traumatic experience for himself. We've talked about it maybe once or twice in our time since that day. But, he's your typical old school fella that wouldn't want to talk about it and, you know, hard as a rock. So, it was quite a traumatic experience for himself, obviously, and the people that were there on the day. To be fair, there was no feeling whatsoever. I didn't really get any feeling until months later after the recovery, you know. So, yeah.
So you actually died. You actually died.
In the report, yes, that's exactly what happened because it entered through the side of my head. So, you know, it obviously stopped everything. And 30 seconds later, went through my chest, and that's what brought it back, you know, like a CPR pretty much. So you know, like I say, I wasn't really, I was conscious through a certain part of the accident until they put me in an induced coma, the paramedics, when they did turn up. So, but for that moment of, you know, in between, for about the first 10, 15 minutes of the event itself, I have no recollection whatsoever of it.
So you didn't have one of these near-death experiences where you were taken to another place and saw lost relatives or anything like that. It was just a blackout, was it?
It was just a blackout, yeah, to be fair. Yeah, all that sort of stuff happened later on down the line. But, you know, that was, for that exact moment of time, yeah, there was nothing at all. It was just complete blackout. I remember having to go up to the highest point of the machine because I had no reception on my phone at the time. So I realized that. And so I went up to the highest point, done the phone call, and I remember just backing away from the tree. I remember having the vision of the tree and backing away, and that was it, just blackout. So... Yeah.
So did the machine actually hit the wire and then electrocuted you through the machine? Is that how it worked rather than you having direct contact with something?
The power jumped 4 meters.
Oh, really? It jumped?
Yeah, it jumped, yeah.
Four meters is quite a distance, actually.
It is, mate, yeah. So I think what happened was I've never actually seen the report itself. You know, we're just going off hearsay from, you know, my father and reports from when it went to court and stuff. But power would have jumped 4 meters. I think personally it would have, the tree has touched my machine, which are both earth to the ground itself and being wet. It was windy, it was cold. And I think what's happened is the tree has touched my machine. And because of that being wet as well, the power lines were going through the trees themselves. So the 110 kV. Yes, so it was like the conductor, you know. It was just, and it's caused by a flashover or electrical arc flash, they call it. And that's what makes, because power does jump, especially when it's raining. You can hear it. You can hear it, especially high voltage. You can always hear it if you're close to them. So, yeah, it was just well, unfortunate for the first 10, 11 years. I look at it now like it is a fortunate thing because of all the things that have happened since. But yeah, just at that moment in time, it was, how would you say it? You take for granted, you know, the power of electricity, I suppose, you know. It was, you underestimate it. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, I guess it's like being struck by lightning pretty well, isn't it? At that power, anyway, 110,000 volt power lines.
Yes.
So when you came to after the second one, which sparked you back into life, though I'm sure caused way more damage.
Yes.
You were conscious. Could you easily gather your thoughts and wonder or understand what had just happened to you?
So the second one that brought me back, I didn't really recollect any of that. So my father had seen me up in flames. So my whole body was up in flames. My arms were swinging around. Body was, you know, there was all of the, he gave me a brief description of what it looked like.
Hmm.
But you know, maybe about a few minutes later, because what had happened is all the voltage, you know, the 200,000 volts had settled on the ground by that stage. And what happens is creates like an electrical ground current. So you can't go anywhere near the machine anyway for like a brief minute. You know, it's about a minute or 40 seconds or so. So he knew that. He could feel the energy. So he knew that he couldn't go anywhere near the machine, but he could just watch me up in flames at that moment in time. So it was, you know, yeah, he didn't really go too much into it, to be fair. You know, like I said, it was just quite a traumatic experience for him to talk about.
No, fair enough. Fair enough. Yeah, seeing your son go up in flames, basically,
exactly.
In front of you.
Yeah, exactly.
So he could feel the energy on the ground around the machine. It's sort of like a capacitor in the ground, which discharges, does it, over a short period of time before you can actually be in that area?
Yeah, like if he went anywhere near the machine at that time, because if you're lifting your feet, for example, you know, you're getting trained and, you know, I'm not an expert on this side, but if you get electrocuted, like the machine does, sorry, you can't jump out of the machine and try and run away or anything, because as soon as you put your foot down and then you lift your other foot off, you're creating, you know, like the energy to go through your body, and that's it.
So you're breaking the circuit, so therefore it tries to channel through you still.
It'll go straight through you. Yeah. So my father could feel that. He didn't know that knowledge, obviously, but
he could feel something.
Energy. Yeah. He just knew, like, holy shit, like, you know.
Don't go there for a moment, or whatever.
Yeah, don't go anywhere near the machine. And so he just had to watch. And then around about a minute later, one of the other workers went over, because we have a manual control on the hydrolators themselves, and that actually makes it lower down instead of having to try and do it up there. So, yeah, they ended up able to lower me down, and then they pulled me out of the machine, laid me on the ground, and that's when I remember being conscious and trying to get up and move, and that's when I remember hearing my father, you know, crying, breaking down and stuff. And from that point on, I knew that, like, I must be in a bad way, because my father, you know, he never cries, he never shows emotion. So that's when I knew, I was like, shit, it must be bad. But I couldn't see anything. I was completely blind at that stage.
Oh, is that part of the shock?
Well, yeah, I think the body was in shock. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm actually blind in my left eye nowadays.
Okay, from that?
Yes, yeah. Well, you know, it must have been the opposite, because it hit me in the right side of the ear, but my left eye is completely blind. So, yeah, it must have been the side effect of it, yeah.
It's incredible that the human being can take such a shock of energy, though, and survive. But you had third-degree burns. How are third-degree burns, what makes them third-degree? Is it the layer of skin involved or how deep it goes? Could you explain that?
So third-degree just pretty much means there's no layers of skin whatsoever. So we all have seven layers or, you know, around that. I'm not a doctor, to be fair, but I've got no layers of skin whatsoever. So, you know, all of my arms and my body, they've got no layers of skin whatsoever.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And it's painful, isn't it? Getting burnt is a lot of pain, am I right?
Yeah, well, I mean, I was on morphine and everything for a very long, you know, about 3 to 4 months of that period. So I didn't really feel the pain until I, you know, voluntarily wanted to get off it, because I started realizing, because I was never going to walk or talk again. But about 6 weeks in, I got my first steps in, and pushed through, and I knew from that stage that I was becoming reliant on it. So I wanted to get off it to try and, you know, I was trying to recover fast. That's pretty much it.
So were you told that you would never do this or never do that or whatever again? Were you told that?
Well, I wasn't even supposed to survive. I mean, you know, I was like using over 9,000 calories a day. The heart rate was at on an average of 230 beats per minute at that stage for the first 3 days of the recovery. So that's why the doctors were being realistic with the family and friends at the time. And they were just like, well, he's not going to make it. You just have to come and pay your final respects. And so, you know, it was a big turnout, which maybe spiritually that was enough for me to push through, maybe. But to be fair, I was training I was in physical shape beforehand because I was training for rugby. So I wanted to get into the, you know, into the reps or something like that. And plus 2011 on the same week as the World Cup final, you know. So that was what gave me that drive to want to get into the 2012 rugby season fit, strong and ready to go.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it was just to survive this. So, you know, yeah. But
well, that's interesting, isn't it? What you just said there, that maybe fortunately that it was to survive that. If you were any less fit and ready, would you have survived it, do you think?
No way. There's no way, because even months to a year prior to that, I was on a complete opposite side of the spectrum in terms of my lifestyle, you know, the type of environment that I came from. I came from a, you know, gang culture environment and drugs and alcohol and everything
else. Okay, yeah. So
it was like maybe about 4 to 5 months beforehand, I said to myself that I was over the whole life, like completely, and I wanted to get into like training again. And because I had natural talent for rugby and stuff, and I believed that I could make it all the way. And, you know, you're 5, 6 years of age and you've got the dreams of becoming an All Black, and, you know, I had my idols and everything. So at that time, I thought, you know, I need to give it another crack. I'm still young, still got time, and started training really hard for it. And, you know, I'm very fortunate nowadays, obviously, because of all the great things that have happened since. But, yeah, for a very long time, for the first probably decade of the accident itself, I looked at it like it was a curse as opposed to a blessing. So, yeah.
Interesting that you see it. Well, I'm assuming that you're saying it's a blessing. Reflecting over that time, do you think that it happened for a reason then?
Well, 3 years after the accident was my daughter. She was born. So that was the blessing, you know, and she's the one that kept me going through this whole dark period, because for the first 10, 11, 12 years, it was hell, to be fair. But the only thing that kept me on this earth, you know, with all honesty, was the fact that I didn't want to leave this earth with my daughter not having her father. So that's the thing that pushed me through all of the dark periods, because suicide was like a daily thing for a very long time, going through
really?
All of it.
Yep.
Yeah, definitely, man. I don't have those feelings nowadays, but, you know, mental health is still a real big issue for me at this stage, which is why I want to become an advocate for it, because, you know, I know firsthand of the experiences that I've been through. Even before this accident, but, you know, especially after this one. And it's not easy, you know, it's not easy trying to be grateful on a daily basis and realize that, you know, I've got a tool or gift now to help others. So, yeah.
So you've got to get out and use it, right? That's almost the quid pro quo of surviving, I guess. You can't not do anything with that. You can't just let that run riot, right? Yeah.
Yeah, it's been like, you know, the last year or two that I finally realized that this is something that can help others. This, you know, because I've always been that type of person. Even in that old environment that I came from, I was still trying to help a lot of people in that world, you know. And you know, a lot of those people, obviously, you know, you can lead the horse to water, but you can't make them drink it, right? And I used to put a lot of time and energy into people instead of myself. So I finally started doing it on myself these days in the last year or two, and a lot of things have definitely changed for the better.
So how do you aim to, you know, do this mission? Who do you talk to? Who do you get in contact with? Who's listening? Who's creating opportunities? Are you creating opportunities? Because I think you've been entrepreneurial, it's fair to say, in that time. You've got a fresh fruit and vegetable business, ironically involving avocados. So So how do you go about it, of getting what you have to say out there?
Well, the avocado sale, so I was actually contracting for the first 5 to 8 years of, you know, after the accident. I had to convince my father to jump back on one again, because obviously for the first few years I couldn't do anything at all.
Right.
But I wanted to, you know, get a machine, and I wanted to build it and get, you know, bigger and bigger, whatever, like a success story, I suppose, if that's the case. But we also wanted to be self-employed, because we were working for another company at the time of the accident. So we wanted to be self-employed and a family-run business. So that was the goal. And then I eventually convinced my father to jump back on one, and he done it for many years before I jumped back on one again, because I was incapable. I just couldn't move, and, you know, I could barely move for many years, to be fair. But as soon as I could, I got another one, jumped on it myself, and worked for a few years. And then I sort of lost passion for it, to be fair. And then I'd done a presentation for Fuld & Hogan and Bay of Plenty probably about 3 years ago. And that's when I transitioned over to doing sales of avocados and stuff, because it forced me to have people approach me and talk to people, because I was a very self-conscious person. I didn't want to talk to anybody.
Mm.
And so after a year of doing that, it picked my confidence up to be able to just face people and you know, just not be shy, not be embarrassed, not be self-conscious about my look, of how I look and stuff. So it built my confidence for that as well. And so I've just sort of carried on with that. But I've realized now that my real fulfillment, my real passion would be to go and do presentations, be in the community, the youth, children, you know, to just anti-bullying campaigns, because I do a lot of, so I do a kids camp up in Auckland every year for the Burns Group, and all the kids from around New Zealand sort of connect up for 4 days, 5 days, and we all get together. And I realize at that stage too, there's a lot of bullying that goes on within, you know, our Burns kids. And it's something that I'm just really passionate about, because, you know, I treat them like my own kids now. So I just really want to go out there and give awareness of people that look different to.
So kids with burns, because I remember at school a few had scars from, you know, hot baths, those sorts of accidents. I don't remember anyone ever bullying them or singling them out, though, for that. I guess it happens. It's horrible.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's not like talked about, you know. It's just I have talks personally with some of these kids, and that's what it's about, you know. Like, they're not going out telling the teachers or stuff like that. And there's just a couple of stories that I hear within, you know, because us parents, we're all talking as well, you know. At the end of the day, we're all just talking about how the day went, and, you know, we bring things up. So, you know, I only have to hear a couple of them. I don't, you know, it's not like it's common, but it's enough for me to know that I was that kid at the best of stages, being the bully and being bullied myself. So it's still out there, you know. So I suppose it's just the awareness that I really want to put out there. And because, you know, kids are raw and honest, especially at a young age, you know, they're just,
So if people want to find out more, Troy, you've got a website, troyhall.co.nz.
Yep.
And people can go there. And also been looking at some of the pics you've got in the gallery there, some well-known people that you're kind of up next to, Mike King being one. Are you impressed with the work he's been doing? Because that's been a little controversial, gotta say.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, everyone has their you know, insight on that, and that's understandable, you know. I don't really follow it all, to be fair. I just sort of like anyone that's advocating, you know, mental health, because it's just something that I truly believe in too, because I'm going through it personally myself. So it goes from even the Christchurch victims of the earthquakes and everything like that. It affects people in a lot of ways. So, I mean, the more people that are out there at least giving awareness for it, I mean, it can only be a good thing. Like I say, I don't know the controversial sides, to be fair. You know, I don't sort of dive into that. But he was just there at a presentation I was doing myself. He'd done his first presentation, and I followed him.
Gotcha. Yeah. I'm looking at a picture of you, I think, in 2011. After you're in hospital, obviously. Oh, my God, mate. You look like some sort of starving refugee from some other part of the world. It's incredible now looking at you to see how you've rebuilt yourself, basically.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it. Yeah, I mean, that at that stage, that was like I was saying, it was like 9,000 calories a day the body was using at the moment. But that proves how powerful our bodies are, eh? You know, our human bodies. So it's yeah, it's a resilience thing, and it can withstand anything. To be fair, so yeah.
And your daughter, is it Neve? Is that how I pronounce her name?
Nevaeh.
She must be proud of her old man.
Oh yeah, she gets shy about it. To be fair, she doesn't like being. Oh my God, don't talk about me. It's like, well, honey, you're the reason why Daddy's still here. You know,
sorry. So, yeah,
I'm sorry, honey, but you have to be. You know, because you know, yeah, we have our talks about it. But she's only 10 at the moment, so she doesn't really understand. You know, the impact that she has. But yeah, she's an amazing soul. That one, she knows how to say the right things at the right time. So yeah.
Well, it's been really interesting chatting with you, Troy. What an incredible thing to, well, experience, and then to turn, as you say on your website, adversity into strength in that way. But it's taken a while, right? It's not just click your fingers. It's taken a decade.
That's right. It's definitely been a journey, I tell you. And that's why I go out to, you know, companies and health and safety days and stuff like that, to just make the awareness that attitude is everything. With the right attitude, you know, you could avoid having to experience all of this. And that's pretty much what I'm trying to do, just the awareness to make people understand the importance of attitude. And it's something that I really advocate nowadays, because, you know, I don't wish this journey upon anyone. And it's not even about electrocution. It could be any incident. You know, you could lose limbs, you could be paralyzed. Anything could happen at any time. So it's just being aware of your surroundings, both on the work site and out there and, you know, just in life in general, to be fair.
Yeah, never forget that it could all change in an instant.
Tomorrow's never promised, mate.
Okay, Troy Hall, thanks for coming on and talking about your experience. Really interesting. Thank you.
Appreciate it, mate. Thank you.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.